my samadhi with the four jhanas. Whereas the gradual training takes you all the way up to awakening. So there is another exposition in the sutras known as the tenfold path, which goes beyond the jhanas and all the way to liberation. And it actually matches more perfectly onto that one. But roughly, it is the same thing. So I have always found this particular exposition extremely useful in my own life as a monastic, because it gives you this possibility of it gives you the outline of what you have to do. So let's see what it has to say. So the simile of the elephant's footprint, and the idea here, just to give you the background, I have kind of chopped off the first 10 paragraphs of the sutta. And the background here is that the Buddha gives the simile of what he calls an elephant, as translated into English as the elephant woodsman. The elephant woodsman is a person who goes into the woods and he... is it an elephant woodsman or maybe something else? No, I think it's just somebody who sees an elephant footprint. And he gives the idea of how do you know whether something is a real big elephant, right? You go into the forest and you start, if you see a kind of big footprint, and you think, okay, I've seen the big footprint, so now there is a chance that this might be a big bull elephant, right? He's searching for a big bull elephant. And then he sees the footprint, so this might be it. And then he moves on and he sees some scrapings high up on the trees. And this is what the elephants do. They scrape high up on the trees to kind of get the branches and the leaves to eat and this sort of thing. So again, this is another sign that this might be a big bull elephant. And he moves on like that and he sees the different marks, the different characteristics, the different things that a big elephant would do. But he cannot still be absolutely sure, right? There might be another elephant who is very tall or whatever. And it's only when you actually see that bull elephant with your own eyes, that's when you know that this definitely must be a big bull elephant. And this is the simile here, is the same for this particular sutta. It's the idea that you practice this path, and as you practice this path, you start to see more and more marks of the Buddha. But only when you actually reach the awakening yourself, that is when you know that this must have been taught by somebody who had this particular realization. This is the idea here. That's why it's called the simile of the elephant's footprint. And of course, in the sutta itself, there is this Brahmin. A Brahmin, of course, the priestly caste in those days. There's a Brahmin who goes to see the Buddha. And he sees how the Buddha takes all these people, has a debate with all different kind of people. People from different religious backgrounds, people of different castes. And then after he has seen the Buddha, he says to this other Brahmin, he tells him what happened. And he said, wow, I saw the Buddha debating with all these people. And then not only does he win the debate, but after the debate, the people who held these various views, they abandon their views and they become disciples of the Buddha. So for that reason, I know the Buddha must be kind of awakened. And then the Buddha says, no, you don't know that. That's not enough, right? Okay, this is nice, but that's not how you know someone is awakened. The way you know someone is awakened is by practicing the same path and then achieving the same result. And then you know that teaching leads to that particular goal, and they must have had the same kind of insight. So the Buddha is very pragmatic, right? There's no kind of messing around. He tells the truth as it is. And this is one of the great things about this. It comes through in the suttas all the time. There's no kind of pretense or anything like that. Okay, so let us see what this sutta has to say. So we're going to do the sutta in stages, and this is the first part of the sutta. So after delivering the simile of the elephant, then the Buddha says, so too, Brahmin, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable, leader of persons to be tamed, teachers of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. Right? Does anyone recognize that particular paragraph? Yes? Okay, yeah, good. This is the kind of standard salutation to the Triple Gem. It's the Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho, right? Whenever you do that verse, if you do it in Pali, do it in English, it's good to know the meaning. So if you do it in Pali, this is what it actually means, right? And this is the standard recollection of the Buddha that is given in the suttas. When you listen how the Buddha recommends that you should actually reflect on the qualities of the Buddha. So, and remember that this idea of reflecting on the Buddha, or the Dhamma, or the Sangha, whatever it is, this is actually a technique of giving rise to a sense of joy and happiness. This is a technique to get your meditation to start off, right? So this is actually quite a useful and quite important thing to do. So remember that, and when you remember that, this kind of paragraph becomes so much more powerful. This is one reason I want to explain it in a little bit of detail, so that you actually, when you reflect on this, it actually has an opportunity to give rise to a sense of confidence or even joy when you do this. The whole idea of these reflections is to give rise to a sense of peace and joy, so that your meditation becomes more powerful. This is what this is all about. So you need to kind of imbue these sort of things, these kind of paragraphs, with meaning, with something which really relates to you. And then when it relates to you, then it actually starts to have a powerful effect. So, first thing he says here a Tathagata appears in the world. Here usually just means right here in this world. That's what basically it means here. In this world, among humanity or whatever. A Tathagata appears in the world. So it sounds a bit mysterious, doesn't it? The Tathagata appears in the world. Well, you know, how exactly does that happen? And it is not mysterious at all. And this is the point here. First of all, the Tathagata, of course, is a Buddha, is someone who awakens. This is a word that existed in India prior to the time of Buddhism. And it was taken on board by the Buddhists as someone of great spiritual accomplishment. That's basically what the Tathagata means. It means something else, but the exact meaning is not clear. And it's probably meant to be a little bit mysterious, right? It doesn't have a precise meaning. It just means someone who is very highly attained in spiritual matters. He appears in the world. So what that means, it doesn't just mean that someone suddenly appears out of nowhere. All it means really is that occasionally in this world there will be someone who has the necessary qualities to be able to make a profound spiritual breakthrough and see things according to reality. That's all it means. So every now and again, every kind of, you know, a few according to the suttas, it's quite rare, right? It happens just maybe every few thousands or millions of years or whatever. But occasionally it will happen that someone has built up the qualities. And this happens more or less by accident, right? According to the suttas, there is no path to become a Buddha. There isn't any way of doing that. Because there is darkness. If there is no Buddhism around, you don't have any path to become a Buddha. It just happens that someone, through their own wisdom, through their own conditioning, through their own, all the factors that have worked on them over a long period of time, they're able to somehow navigate this to actually get to the point where they're able to reach awakening. It's a perfectly natural process. There's nothing mysterious about it at all. And that's why it will always happen at regular intervals that someone is able to break through in this way. It's a natural thing, right? And this again to me is the beauty of the Buddhist teachings. It's all about natural things. There's nothing supernatural really here at all. It happens according to cause and effect. Somebody is able to break through, see things according to reality, and then of course bring that message out to the world. And I think it's a very important point that there is no path here, right? When a Tathagata arises in the world, he doesn't do that through a path. Certainly not according to the early suttas. There's nothing in the early suttas which talks about the bodhisattva path and all these kind of things. Because there's nobody around to teach you. This happens as a matter of cause and effect and not as a matter of a conscious practice of the path. So then the Tathagata appears in the world. So what is it about the Tathagata? Well, the Tathagata is accomplished, it says here. Accomplished is a translation of the word arahant, right? And arahant again means someone who has attained the highest kind of attainment within the Buddha's teachings. And the word arahant actually means worthy. It means someone who is worthy. So what are they worthy of? Well, they're worthy of respect, right? They're worthy of, as it says in the sutta, they're worthy of dakinas, like generosity, of kindness, of respect, of all these kind of things. Why? because they have something that's very valuable to all of us. If someone discovers the truth, the reality about the universe, and is able to give you a path that leads, is for your own benefit and for the benefit of all beings, well, it means that they have the highest truth that we possibly could have. And because of that, they're worthy of respect. You respect someone who is able to give you something very extremely useful in your life. And they're worthy of generosity and kindness because they are giving you something even more important in return. So this is what it basically means, to be worthy, right? You're worthy of whatever we can do for them. They are worthy of that, essentially, because they give you something much more in return. Fully enlightened, Samma Sambuddho. And the word Buddha is actually means awakened in Pali and in Sanskrit and all these languages. Some of the European languages, remember that the European languages and Indian languages and many other languages as well, in Persian and many of Middle Eastern languages, all of these languages are related to each other. They're part of the same heritage called the Indo-European language group. So because of that, you find that some of these words, they are still today, they are the same in Europe and in India, right? And Buddha is one of those words. And there are places in Eastern Europe, I think in Russian, the word Buddha still means awakened. You wake up in the morning, you are Buddha, right? That's what it means. There's a slight, obviously different meaning from the awakening here, but the general idea is the same, that you are awake, right? I like this idea of being awake. It means that you see things, you're not deluded, you see things as they actually are. The word enlightenment is often so used so broadly across the board for all kinds of spiritual traditions and all kinds of things. It kind of has lost its meaning here. But the word awake also speaks to me much more directly. You open your eyes, suddenly you see something. Before you were in darkness, right? You were sleeping. You couldn't really see things. You were fantasizing about things. But seeing things as they actually are is the idea of being awake. The idea now to really understand what is going on. That's what the Buddha is. Someone who is awake. Someone who is no longer asleep. Someone who is seeing the light, right? We're not in darkness. That's what the awakening is all about. Perfect in true knowledge and conduct, vijja chadana sampanno, or endowed with true knowledge and conduct. True knowledge here is a translation of vijja. And vijja, again, is also one of those words which exist in the English language. This is related to the English word wit, right? Wit can mean you're funny, or it can mean you're intelligent or clever, right? You have someone who has the wits about them means somebody who's kind of smart, right? And not stupid. And that's related to the word vijja. So it means like here it has the idea of the highest kind of knowledge that you can have. And of course in Buddhism, that highest knowledge is considered, it's the things that you get at the very end of the Buddhist path. It's the recollection of past lives, understanding the laws of karma, and also the awakening experience itself. Those are the three things of vijja. This is called the true knowledges, because they are knowledges which actually really matter, right? Now you're seeing the world for what it actually is. You understand the world in a very profound sense. So they're called translated as true knowledge here, not just kind of knowledge about all kinds of stuff, which is useful as well, but the deep existential knowledge about the human condition, what we are all about. But important here, not just perfect in knowledge, but also in conduct, right? He's endowed with conduct as well. Charana. And that is a very important point, that knowledge in Buddhism is not something that kind of has no effect on who you are as a person, on how you act. If you have true knowledge, if you see things as they actually are, it affects your outward conduct, your outward behavior. There is no crazy wisdom in the early suttas, right? The idea of crazy wisdom whereby you are very wise but your conduct is kind of not really reflected in that wisdom. Wisdom and conduct always goes together. If you have true knowledge, if you understand the world as it actually is, it's going to do something to you. And you're going to start acting in a new way. And of course, that conduct is described at length in the suttas, but it includes things like virtue and kindness and peace, not getting angry, not having desires, not being proud, not being conceited, being humble, having few wishes. All of these things that we think of as spiritual qualities, right? You're chanting them in the Metta Sutra this morning. All of these things are part of what conduct means here. And that is, of course, very important, because what it means is that it is possible for us to have some idea of who has attained awakening here. We can tell. You can just, when somebody comes around and you observe them carefully over a long period of time, you can have some idea of whether somebody is awakened or not. And if somebody is awakened, they will have the conduct that matches with that awakening experience. And that makes it possible for us to have some idea of judgment, some idea of being able to judge for ourselves. And this is, of course, very important. And be very careful. Sometimes you will hear, oh, you know, awakening is so profound and so different. You can't ever really know. You know, it is kind of beyond our ability to understand. But the Buddha says, no, it is not really beyond our ability to understand. And it is our duty to actually look and to be able to see if those qualities are there. If we don't look, if we don't actually take that responsibility on board to look for ourselves, then we're going to be led astray. So you have to look for these things. You have to look whether the qualities are there. And only then, when you see the right qualities, only then can you have some sort of confidence that what you are seeing is actually the real thing. This is not a foolproof method, because these things are often difficult. Sometimes people may seem outwardly very kind of together and all this kind of things. Excuse me. But sometimes the underlying reality is a bit different. So sometimes you may come to the wrong conclusions anyway. At the very least, you know that if somebody acts in the wrong way, the conduct is not perfect or endowed with good conduct, you can be fairly, at very least, you can doubt whether they really have attained what they are claiming or other people claim they have attained. It's important to do that. It's important to take the spiritual path, take responsibility for your own spiritual life. You don't get led astray by all these things which are uncertain in the world there. And sometimes you hear people say, I don't really know. How can I possibly know that somebody is awakened? I'm going to trust the word of this person over here or these people because I think they know her. But, how do you know that this other person, who decides that this other person is trustworthy to listen to? You decide, right? You still have to decide that this other person should be listened to. So in the end, you are the one who makes the judgment regardless. You have to make the judgment about where to get your information from, what to trust. So go straight to the source and look for yourself, and don't be afraid of these things. It is very important to have that sense of trusting one's own ability to be able to recognize these things. Otherwise, you're going to be led astray. And there's so much of these things happen in the world because people are seeking for spiritual teachings to give their life meaning, which of course is very important. And that is, I think this is very, of course, very significant and very matters. And it's great that people do that. But you have to have enough confidence in yourself to take that responsibility fully and actually watch and make some judgment as to who is worthy of that trust, who is worthy of the confidence and faith, and who is not. It's very important. And then you will not be taken for a ride, right? You will not be abused or whatever else, or at the very least getting bad teachings when there are good ones around. So I may talk more about that later on, because this is quite an interesting topic, this idea. But how do we know, where to place our confidence? What are the real teachings? Who knows about the world in the proper way? It's a fascinating area to look at. So, and it says here, sublime. The word sublime in Pali is sugato. And sugato means, su means good. So it means someone who has attained some kind of happiness, someone who has reached something good. That's really all it means. And of course here it means having reached what is good in the highest sense. Knower of the worlds, or knower of the world. The idea behind this is that when someone is awakens. It means that for it to be called, for it to be a proper awakening, you really have to understand the world. You have to know what the world is all about. And specifically, it means understanding the world in terms of happiness and suffering, right? And this is, I think, the, as I was saying yesterday, this is what we all want. We want to be happy. We want to be away from suffering. Everything we are trying to reach in life, whether it is a career, a family life, whether it is just ordinary things in daily life, it all comes back to the sense of fulfillment, being complete, being happy, being at peace, all these positive qualities that we're always seeking, right? So the Buddha is someone who understands the world in terms of happiness and suffering. He's one who understands the world in terms of the very thing that we are craving for, that we are desiring. All these things that we are running around trying to achieve in our lives. The Buddha has understood the world in terms of that craving. And of course, for that reason, this is why he's called the knower of the world. A knower of the world here means that he has understood that, not just a kind of in the human sense, and understood that fully and completely in the human sense, but even if there is a world beyond the human world. In Buddhism, we talk about other realms of rebirth, we talk about devas and all these kind of things. And of course, the Buddha, he must have understood all the entire potential, right? So if there is a world beyond the human one, which the Buddha said there is, then he has understood all of this, the whole potential for happiness and suffering. And then once you understand the whole potential of happiness and suffering, only then can you decide how you should live your life, right? What is there a problem or is there not a problem? What should I be focusing on? What is and if you come to the decision, and this is of course what the Buddha does, he sees for himself that the suffering far outweighs the happiness, and that is when you seek for the escape, right? The escape comes as a consequence of that. And only then, when you have seen the full picture, the whole range, the entire possibilities, only then can you be called a knower of the world. And only then do you can you actually help people, or help beings in general, to actually move in the right direction. So knower of the world, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. And of course, once you know the world, once you understand happiness and suffering, in the full extent, then you that's why you are incomparable, right? You are incomparable because you are one of these people, the only one, presumably at that time, who understands this to its full extent. So even if there are devas around or whatever, then they will still have a limited understanding because they haven't actually had this type of insight that the Buddha has. This is the idea behind someone who awakens. So you are a comparable leader of persons to be tamed. I think a better translation there is obtainable persons. In other words, persons that can be tamed rather than persons to be tamed. And the idea there is that there are certain people who can be tamed and others who cannot. There are certain people who have little dust in their eyes, certain people who are, you know, who are kind of understand that it's good to be virtuous, it's good to be kind, it's good to practice a bit of meditation, it's good to look at the world in a certain way. But there are the vast majority of people haven't got that ability. They are just because of their background, because of their past life, because of whatever, they haven't got the ability to even get started. And this, of course, is the problem. So there are certain people who can be tamed because they have the right faculties. But then there are others. You can teach them as long as you like, but they're never going to come around to seeing the world in this way. So there's only a subgroup that are tameable. And the Buddha is the leader of these people. The Buddha has seen, he has understood, and he has part of that seeing and understanding the world in terms of happiness and suffering is also understanding the path, right? This is the thing about the insight into the Dhamma, is that part of that insight is to see also the path that leads to these things. And because you have seen the path, that is why you also become the leader, right? You lead people in the right direction. So you are the incomparable leader of tameable persons. Anuttara Purisa Dhamma Sarati. Teacher of gods and humans. Satta deva manusanang teach from gods and humans. And the idea here is that gods, they are beings just like humans, right? The devas are beings just like humans. They transmigrate, they get born now here, now there. And they are subject to delusion, just as we are. The gods of Buddhism are not so godly as the gods of other religions, right? They're just fairly, they're just kind of in there just like us. They got maybe a bit more power and glory and happiness, but in the end, they have the same delusion and problems as we have. And that's why anyone who is able to break through that delusion is able to be a teacher to both gods and humans. The Buddha is enlightened again. Enlightened again. So again, Buddha, or Samma Sambuddho, and he is blessed. Blessed here is Bhagava. And this word Bhagava is an Indian word which means something like Lord, right? It means something like, in India, the Bhagava is always when someone has a god or something that they believe in, when someone is a leader of a religious sect, they often call them Bhagava. Lord is actually quite a good translation. So you had some of these... I don't know if you remember these spiritual leaders from, you probably heard of them, like Rajneesh, for example, also called Osho, and he called himself Bhagava, I think, yeah. Even though he was a real scallywag, he called himself Bhagava, Lord, right? That's kind of the leader of the sect. So, that is the idea of the Buddha. So this gives you, you can reflect on these things yourself. There's a lot of information in that very short paragraph. So reflect on that, because it actually is quite inspiring if you reflect on these things in the right way. So then, having done this, having acquired this understanding of happiness and suffering, of what the world really is about, the next thing is that the Tathagata, the Buddha, the one who has awakened to all this, he declares this to other people, right? This is the second thing. So the Buddha kind of appears in the world, and the first thing he does is to understand. And then when he declares it, later on in the suttas, it is said, a very beautiful thing that's said about the Buddha. He said to be the eye of the world, right? The eye of the world, this idea that someone has seen something, and because they have seen something, they can lead others. So the Buddha is the eye, whereby everybody else can kind of sort of see, because the Buddha is the eye, and the rest of us follow along. So the Buddha is the eye of the world. It's a beautiful saying. And that's why he teaches, right? That's what the teaching is all about. Once he teaches, that's how he becomes this eye for the rest of the world. He says, this is what the world actually is like. And this is what we will be seeing here when he discloses his teachings. So he declares this world with its gods, the devas, its maras and its brahmas. This generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes, or should really be gods there as well, with its gods and people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. With the right meaning and phrasing here, he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. So, having himself realized with direct knowledge, right? The Buddha's teaching is not a teaching that is theoretical. Sometimes you hear people bandy around this word metaphysics. Metaphysics, they say, oh, the Buddha is teaching metaphysical teachings. And metaphysics just means that it's a theory, it's something made up in the mind. It's not really something which has been experienced. And they say that because the Buddha teaches things like rebirth and all these kind of things. But of course, from a Buddhist point of view, it's not metaphysics at all. This is a real experience, right? And this is the whole point here. The Buddha has realized with direct knowledge. This is what he's saying here. Having realized this with direct knowledge, only then does he proclaim things. So this idea that these kind of teachings are just theory, that they are just made up, is completely wrong from the Buddhist point of view. And I think that comes from Western ideas. It comes from our Western world, in the sense that from the Western world, a religious kind of teaching like this must by definition be theory, because it's not something that you can actually experience. The Buddhist answer is, no, you can experience these things. They can be realized. And that is why That is precisely why that there is a difference here between this type of teaching and perhaps some other teachings. So he declares, after having realized these things, he declares it to everybody else. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and Brahmas. These are just different beings, basically, right? The various realms that exist in this world. This generation with its recluses and Brahmins. In other words, he distinguishes between different types of recluses and Brahmins. These are Samana, Brahmana Samana. Samana, all the religious people at the time of the Buddha in India, they were the Samanas. It's a word that is directly related to the European word or English word shaman, right? A shaman is a samana. This is a word that are related to each other. So he knows this generation. He knows the different teachings, the different religious groupings, and he knows how they all work and which ones are true to reality and which ones are not. It's devas and his humans. So what does it mean that you declare this world? And this is exactly what I was saying before. It means that you don't only understand the human realm and the kind of the possibilities and potentials in the human realm, but you have this larger understanding of the potential in the entire universe. What is the human potential? How far can it go in a positive direction? What is the highest kind of rebirth you can possibly take? And according to Buddhism, there are some pretty amazing types of rebirths, right? You can get into these extremely profound states of samadhi, like things like the immaterial attainments, and you can get reborn in those states. And according to the suttas, you can stay in those realms for thousands of eons. An eon in Buddhism is quite similar to the idea of eons, perhaps, not entirely sure, but it seems to be similar to the idea of an eon or in kind of modern cosmology, the idea of the expansion and contraction of the universe. You stay there for thousands and thousands of these eons, and all you experience is just pure bliss all the way. It's quite attractive, right? But then the Buddha says, then you move on, and then at another time you may get reborn in these terrible realms of pain. So you have this, you know, this view of the instead of having this narrow view of just the human realm, you have this enormously broad view of what it is possible, the potential of experience. And I think a very useful way of understanding this idea of rebirth and karma is to remember that within the human realm, there's already a range of possible experience. You can be a very poor person who is very uneducated, who is very sick, has all these kind of problems in life. On the other hand, you can be a very healthy person living in a place which is wealthy, being having a good education, coming from a good background, right? So the span within the human realm is quite large. So the way to understand all these other realms is just that you are increasing that span dramatically. Instead of having the human realm like that, you're increasing the span of potential experience many, many, many fold. That's really how to understand it. Sometimes when you read words like Mara and Brahma and Deva, it sounds so alien. It's not alien at all. It's just you experiencing a wider range of happiness and pain. That's all it is. So if you ever become a Deva, a god, right? And you're kind of hanging out in heaven, enjoying yourself, you know, with all these kind of nice things. Sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds at least it's like a holiday or whatever, until you have to finish off your work later on. So you could go there for a holiday. So then you just understand that it's actually you who go there, right? You go to this holiday, you are certainly there. Certainly you find yourself, you're having a different body perhaps, and you have all these extra powers, but it's still you who are there. It's just the expanded range of experience that you have. And this goes in both directions, both for suffering and for happiness. So this is what the Buddha understands. He understands this massive range. And of course, part of what he understands is also the mechanism, right? How it is that you get reborn in one place or another one. And when you understand the mechanism, what you understand is that you can never stay in one place. If you come to a place that is really great, you think, okay, I could hang out here for eternity perhaps. Actually, hanging out anywhere for eternity sounds quite terrible. But anyway, so you think maybe if I'm going to be anywhere for eternity, this is the place I want to be here. But then the Buddha says, no, it doesn't work like that. There is a mechanism by which rebirth takes place. And this is called the mechanism of karma. This is what karma is all about. And because there is a mechanism, you cannot choose to stay. You cannot be anywhere forever. You have to move on after a certain period of time. And that moving on happens according to these laws and these regulations. And that's why, one of the reasons why it is so terrible in a sense, right? Finally you find some happiness, then it gets taken away from you. And this is one of the great sufferings in life, when we finally have some happiness, then it gets taken away. Finally you find the most wonderful partner in life, and you get married and you live very well, and suddenly something happens. Maybe they die, maybe they have an affair with someone else, right? You found some kind of happiness, and then the suffering as a consequence is enormous, because you get, suddenly you get dragged down into reality, you get dragged down into the opposite of what you had before. And the same thing, imagine getting reborn as a deva, as a god, and then suddenly you get reborn in a lower realm, you come back to the human realm again, right? Or even lower perhaps, and then that is suffering compared to the realm you were before. There is this nice sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Payasi Sutta. And in this sutta there's this man who does these experiments, because he wants to find out whether people have a soul or whether they have a mind. So he does all these strange experiments. And one of the experiments he does, he says to his relatives that when one of his old kind of aunties or grandparents are about to die, he tells them that, you know, okay, grandfather, when you die, if you go to the heavenly realm, please come back and tell me, you know, that there is this heavenly realm, so I know about rebirth, right? So please come back and tell me about this. This is what he says to his old grandfather or old grandmother. And then this monk that he's talking to, then he says to this monk that, well, I've said this so many times, and nobody ever comes back, right? Whether they have been reborn in a bad realm or a good realm, nobody ever comes back to tell me. And then this monk, this is called the Kumarakassapa, is the name of this monk, yeah? And the Kumarakassapa tells this man, he says to him, this prince, he says to him that, well, you know, if you were kind of dressed up beautifully with nice clothes, and you had your hair just done, and you had all nice perfumes, and you were perfectly clean, and you know, everything was perfectly right, and somebody dragged you to a cesspit, would you be willing to kind of to jump into that cesspit, like, you know, something terrible? No, of course I wouldn't, says this prince. Well, says Kumarakassapa, just the same thing. If you are a deva, you wouldn't want to come back to the human realm, right? That's what he says. So this is kind of the relative thing. Once you get reborn in the deva loka, the human realm doesn't look so good anymore. Anyway, I'm getting a bit carried away now by some of these stories. But they're really nice little stories that you find in the sutta. So this is what he does. He teaches you this whole understanding of the world, right? And of course this is so important, because when you understand, it's only when you actually understand the world, when you understand what the world is like, it's only then that you can make decisions about how you should conduct yourself, what is right, what is important, what matters and what doesn't matter. First of all, you have to have right view. You have to see things in the right way. You have to see things according to the way things actually are. If you are blind, if you are deluded, if you don't see things as the way they actually are, how can you make the right decisions? It's impossible, right? You have to understand things. This is why right view is so important. Without that, you can't make the right decisions. It's like, I always like just the simple idea of investing on the stock market. If you get really bad information, and people say, invest in this stock and it will make you wealthy, but information you have is really bad, you're going to lose lots of money. Right? But on the other hand, if you have really good information, like insider's information or something like that, which I'm not recommending that you should do that, but if you have that, you're going to make money because you have the good information, right? So this is the same thing. So it leads to suffering. Having wrong view leads to suffering. Having wrong view about what is the good stock to invest in leads to suffering. Much, much worse suffering. Having wrong view about what the world is like and acting on that wrong view leads to far, far more suffering in the long run. So this is why right view is so important. And this is why this is what the Buddha is doing here. He's teaching the way the world actually is. He's imparting right view. He's telling us what the right view is. And this gives us the opportunity to start acting in the appropriate manner. So very, very important. So you can see here, what we're talking about here is the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Right view arising. The eye of the world seeing and then letting us all know what is going on. So he teaches all of these things, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, this is about the human realm, the devas and the gods, because he has realized this with his own direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And this just means that it can mean many different things, and it's explained in many different ways. But it just means that this teaching has benefits all the way, right? It's always beneficial. It always leads in the right way. It always leads towards something good, from the very beginning to the very end. It doesn't mean that there is never any difficulties in practice in the Dhamma. It doesn't mean that you're just blissing out all the way, of course. That's not really what it means. And sometimes you have to restrain yourself, and sometimes you have to experience a little bit of suffering because you can't just do whatever you want. But the general results as you practice will always be good. And this is the idea here, all the way to the end. With the right meaning and the right phrasing. The right meaning here can also be translated as the right goal or the right purpose. The right goal, again, is the goal of happiness, right? Ending with Nibbana. So the goal is the highest happiness possible. In this sense, it has the right purpose. It has a purpose that we all really desire. When it comes to the end of the day, this is the goal that we all desire, the highest happiness in the world. The ending of all suffering, right? And this is where this leads us. It has the right meaning, or the right goal, the right purpose. Atta is the Pali word. The word Atta in Pali is very broad, and it has many different meanings in this, meaning all of these things. Has the right phrasing, Vyanjana. And this is one of those things about the teachings of the Buddha, which is very interesting here. That the Buddha, he doesn't just, often when you hear a Dhamma talk, you will hear people saying all kind of things. But with the Buddha, he is also very careful with the way he phrases his teachings. And I think the reason is because he knows that he is like the pinnacle. He is at the top of this pyramid called Buddhism. He's at the starting point. So because of that, he has to be extremely careful, because he knows that everyone afterwards is going to look back to those teachings and ask, what do they actually mean? This is like the fountainhead of the entire Buddhist tradition. So because it is a starting point and everybody is going to refer to that, it actually matters enormously how he phrases his teachings. So not only is the meaning there endowed with meaning, but also has the right phrasing. The phrasing is very careful. And what that means is that when you start reading the suttas, and we know with fair amount of certainty that many of the suttas as we have them now, some of the passages there are still almost verbatim the same as they were at the time of the Buddha. Not everything is. Some things have been a bit corrupted and things. But certain things, and you can see that through, you can look at the Chinese version of the suttas, compare it to the Pali, etc. And these are different strands of Buddhism that have been apart for over 2,000 years. But when you look at it, it's still virtually identical. So at least some passages are virtually identical in wording even to this day, which is quite astonishing when you think about it, that after over 2,000 years, the wording is basically identical. And it shows you the care that people took in looking after the Buddha's teachings, right? They had this tremendous confidence and tremendous sense of obligation to look after these teachings. They look after them so carefully that after 2,000 years, they're still the same. It's quite astonishing. So what that means is that when you read the suttas, be very careful. There's a lot of meaning in there, and every word has a place. Every little thing, every little syllable has a kind of meaning. So you have to read them very carefully. And this is one of the benefits of learning the Pali language, because then you can actually see these things for yourself even more clearly. These days, the English translations are very good. The translations by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi are excellent, and you get the majority of your... You get a very good understanding of the Dhamma simply by reading these kind of translations. But if you know Pali, I wouldn't really recommend you to learn Pali, because usually life is just too busy for that, unless you have a very, very deep interest. But if you know Pali, you can take it one step further, and you can look into these things even in more depth and more detail. And you can find things and meaning in there which otherwise you wouldn't. Why? Because the phrasing is right? The phrasing is important. And you see that in other suttas as well, where the Buddha talks about, what happens if you have two monastics or two lay people who disagree about the meaning and the phrasing of the sutta, and then he says that, well, if you disagree about the phrasing, he said, it doesn't matter so much. Nevertheless, if you do disagree about something, then the Dhamma should be recited afterwards, so that you are reminded of the phrasing as well, the phrasing and the meaning going together. But the meaning, of course, what really matters, but the phrasing does kind of encode, if you like, that meaning in a very careful way. So it has the right meaning and phrasing, and then he reveals a holy life. This is the brahmacharya, a holy life, maybe called the spiritual life. The spiritual life is the latest translation of this word by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. That is utterly perfect and pure. So the spiritual life, brahmacharya, basically in the meaning of that word is like the celibate life, right? Or the life which consists of basically of sexual abstinence. That's what it means in the Indian tradition of brahmacharya. And it reveals this spiritual life that is utterly perfect and pure. Perfect, the word for perfect here is paripunna in Pali. And paripunna doesn't really mean perfect, it means more like complete. That's what it means. Perfect is a bit ambiguous, but complete is really the meaning of that word. So it is a complete spiritual life. It doesn't miss, it doesn't lack in anything. It is complete in the sense that it is, it leads all the way to the highest possible goal, Nirvana. It's complete in that sense, and it's complete in the sense that it has all the factors required to get there. So the path is complete, and the goal is complete. Both take you all the way, and it's pure, right? When you look at things like one of the things that is so fascinating about the idea of Buddhist morality or Buddhist virtue, this word sila, is how broad it is, how all-encompassing it is, how it takes into account everything we can possibly do as humans. Speech, action, thought, everything is there, and all of that is part of this idea of purity. So you purify yourself all the way to the core, right? You're basically changing your personality. You're changing who you are. You're kind of moving into new areas. You become perfectly pure in all possible aspects. So, there you are. That is the introductory paragraph of the simile of the elephant's footprint. And this is, in a sense, the arising of right view in the world. This is what happens. The Buddha is the arising of right view. And once right view has arisen, then the spiritual path becomes possible. It is quite interesting that what we are dealing with here, we are dealing with a gradual training, right? We're dealing with what we have to do to achieve awakening. And the gradual training begins, surprisingly enough, it doesn't begin with, you know, just having right view or just practicing virtue or whatever. It begins with a Buddha arising in the world. There is no gradual training. It doesn't exist apart from the arising of the Buddha in the world. Because then right view comes into existence, and the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is thereby established. And then that right view can then be communicated to other people. And this is how the whole thing starts off. And then, as a consequence of that, and we will see this later on as we go through this, the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path also come into existence as a consequence. Okay, so that is enough for this morning. Just to remind you that this afternoon there will not be another sutta reading. There will be some interviews this afternoon, and then there will be Q&A again in the evening between 8 and 9. So, I'll see you then.